By now you've gathered what our topic for the morning is. But let's hear this story one more time in words that are a bit more familiar. This is how Luke tells it in chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. To some who were confident of their own righteousness, he looked down on everyone else. Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers and evildoers or adulterers or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of what I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted. There are times where the moral of the story is pretty blatantly obvious. You know who is who, and there's a certain clarity along the way that knows where you need to be in the story. When the little boy who has cried wolf one too many times, no one is left wondering whether it's a bright idea to keep telling tales. Little Red Riding Hood teaches us a basic suspicion of situations that just don't quite seem right, and to trust our senses when things are a little bit off. That, and it's apparently helpful to have an axe-wielding woodsman around when things go sideways. As a frequent conversation in our house, wondering at what is it about the dramatic psyche, the stories that we end up telling our children are often a little bit grim. Imagine my surprise when Emily translated our favorite Bounce Your Kid on a Knee rhyme to include the line about the ravens coming and nibbling on your liver. Awesome. It's a little bit dark. But you know where you stand. You know what's going on. And there's a little room for doubt. The story is very much the same. Like the children's story showed well, we know who to cheer for, and we know where all this leads. And for a change, Jesus finally seems to be talking sense and being fairly clear about it. The characters are relatable and even familiar. The Pharisee, the longtime enemy of Jesus' ministry, is playing the role that he's meant to. The self-righteous, self-important figure who is blameless before the law. And he knows it too. And the other straw man is equally typical. The hated tax collector who sold out the other people for power and wealth. Not only is he a bad guy, he's a traitor. And this prayer does not include the necessary promises of reformation, life change, or the 12 steps for recovering exploiters of Israel that we expect or need to hear. All we get is a plea for mercy, and it can seem a little bit hollow. We can almost hear Jesus' listeners hissing and booing at the proper moments. The fact that it turns out to be the downtrodden of society who is justified before God is not terribly surprising, because we are talking about Jesus here. It's one of his sins. but it's there. And the moral stays with us. Be humble, but the tax collector and your golden. Easily done. We can cheer for the metaphorical tax collectors in our midst and never get too prideful and avoid the pitfalls of hypocrisy like the Pharisee. But I'm not sure that it's that simple. Because whenever we say, well, right, there's one right, there's one wrong, be like the right guy, see, I'm humble when I pray, we kind of fall into the trap that Luke and Jesus set for us. Because we're not Pharisees, and thank God for that, we can know that we are humbler and more modest as the sinner that we know that we are. But I think there's more going on here about us and our behavior when it relates to God than just, well, be like the right one. Because as is so often the case, we read the lessons of Jesus expecting advice of how to be and behave and believe. And that's what we get. And we get good advice, and thankfully so. But I always say that there's another level to be had as well. Because we also need to hear and listen and think about what is God doing in this story? What does this tell us about God and all, how this all means? And on that level, I think this story speaks well on both sides of the story. The Pharisee knows who is who and what he is, and he goes with that, and that's great. He makes up his recitation of all the ways that he is doing the work that needs to be done. I'm fasting, I'm giving, I'm tithing, and he's gotten good at it, and he's, well, proud of it. But in doing so, he confuses his life and his discipleship and discipline for the source of that life and the direction of the practice. He forgets that all that he does is not about making him a better Jew. It's about responding to God with him and becoming more like God. And that the knowledge that all of this points to is about being more of that which loves God with heart, mind, and soul, and neighbor as itself. The minute that we take the heart of the parable is simply don't be the Pharisee, we're subject to the very failing that yields the conversation in the first place. And the trap is sprung because it's never about us. It's not about our practice or our humility or our pride or anything like that. Religion is not about you. It's about God. And always will be. On the other side, if we were to take on the role of the tax collector, we have a similar challenge. Here, if we are in that role of being penitent and the self-reproachful sinner, we're also prone to some of the same things. Because we can live our whole spiritual life and not feel the hand of a loving God along the way. We can spend a lot of time worrying whether we belong and whether we have been given the grace that we so often seek. And suspecting that perhaps we never really can or will or should. I know all too well precisely how easy this is, because it doesn't take me a great deal of time to remember how unreformed my heart is or where my pride has entered in my life or in the ways that hubris runs amok. I know that there are ways that I fail to be as devoted as I might be, and there are times where I fear that I fail the particular call to be the spiritual leader that I know that is not only my job, but my privilege and my calling. And at times I can only say, God, have mercy. But if that's all that we can say, and if that's all that we can pull off, we never can stop and hear, yes, I do have mercy. Yes, you are beloved. Yes, you are welcome. Yes, you are my child. The same advice here applies too. It's not about you. It's not about your failings. It's not about your sin. It's about the God who receives you, forgives you, and embraces you all the same. You may well be the wretch or lost sheep or the sinner. Pick whatever term you want. That status is well outstripped by God's ability to work in you and call you my child. And to do things through you and in spite of you and through me and in spite of you, even when we get it wrong. Seeking God is not really about us. It's about God coming and finding us. And what both characters here needed more than anything was simply to know that when you come before God, you are known, you are heard, and you are loved. They needed to come to the temple to know themselves beyond how they just saw themselves, and in the process, know a bit better the God with whom they were praying, leaving his face to be amazed by what happens next. Because when we come with expectations, it's easy for those expectations to always be disappointed. One of the things that I know is a feature of this congregation is the number of people sitting before me who have a pilot's license somewhere in their past. It's always been something that I aspire to, much to Emily's chagrin, but I always loved flying and air travel, even the commercial uncomfortable sort and all the frustrations that come with it. It's one of the few places in our culture left where we actually have to sit by people that we don't know and that we don't understand, and for good or ill, try to get along until we reach our destination together. And it's a fascinating experience. I remember a flight a while back when I was flying to Tucson and got as my seatmates a couple of young tennis players on their way to a tournament. Being young guys and friends, they didn't have much time for the likes of me over in the window seat, which is just fine, and outside of the occasional apology for poking you in the kidney, that's about all we had going for us. And I was off in my little world with my headphones, as we do. But it broke through my awareness at one point in the flight when I heard them talking at length to each other about how completely ridiculous it is that it takes 3 hours to fly from Minneapolis to Tucson, Arizona. What a ripoff! In this day and age, it should take no more than 20 minutes. Where's the teleporter, for crying out loud? And it was also unreasonable that it takes this long. And they went on this way for about 30 minutes of the flight. So After sparing a brief reflection on the nature of youthful indulgence, what struck me about sitting next to them is how adeptly disconnected to any sense of history they were. Because here we are, sitting on a couch at 30,000 feet in the air, moving at speeds that 60 years previously were utterly unheard of. Gone was the long trip across the mountains on horseback, and the reasonable risk was serious injury or death along the way to take the 2 or 3 months that it took to get anywhere. One of the things that has always got me in the West is they kept going. People kept coming, even here. And what more? They stopped. How remarkable is that? And about my friends, I just found it funny that they just had to resent this so much that they couldn't even look at one of the basic minor miracles of technology that we all now take for granted. I think we do the same thing spiritually as well. We can become so used to a world in which we live that we automatically assume that it's the same way for God. We're used to knowing who we are and how we are and where we are based on the metrics that we have. What is it that I do? How is it that I perform? What is it that I earn? And how does it come out on the other side? We know that we're good people because we do good stuff. And then we take that on to God and say, well, see? We meet the way that we perform our spiritual lives, the expectation of that life, and forget that the wonder and the invitation that is there and is ours along the way. It's simply come and be before God and enjoy the one who created us, who calls us, each of us, into relationship, into knowing God. And it's really easy to make our faith about doing, because doing we understand. Being with God and in God and through God, that's a bigger challenge. We would rather it be that we come to God justified on basically how we perform and forget that God comes to us no matter how we are or where we are along the way. And of course, we all want to live good ethical lives. We all want to do the stuff of faith and service. We all want to be the people that we're called to be. And as we should, it's kind of our Anabaptist thing, after all. But all of those things and all of the ways that makes this worthwhile is that it is a response to the relationship with God that we know, and it builds the kingdom that we are promised in the ways that we know best. These choices of being good can only remain what they are ever, because they're a response to the God who first loves us and loves us best. We can make the stuff of our faith our own God or our own shackle. Either knowing that we need to do more or could do more or may do more, or simply knowing how far from God we have fallen and living always in the anticipation and the shadow of the judgment that we have on the way. The faith that justifies us is that at the end of all the behavior and all the prayers and all the stuff and all the doing, God simply comes and is far more than what we can ever imagine or comprehend, and welcomes our confessions inspires our faithfulness, and calls us ever to do that which is new and now. And that's simply to say, yes, I know you're a sinner, but you also know that you are loved. Or, yes, I know that you do good works, but remember always that there are works to reflect me. Or, I know that you don't quite know where you are or how to pray or what to lead, but know that I am seeking you just as you were seeking me. Time and again, we do well to remind ourselves that which we do is not always about us. Our faith is not about us. It's always about God. It's about the God who comes to us in all time and all places and reminds us that we are loved and reminds us of who we are. God's children, each one. That love is not for what we do or how we do it or what we don't do or not do it, but simply that we are loved. It's about the God who makes himself vulnerable enough to come and dwell with us and be with us and know us fully and even die for us by way of showing us that there is no place that we can go that God is not. There's no place where God cannot be, even in the most sinful soul or the most righteous practice. It's about the God who does not see us solely for what we do and does not care where we stand in the social order, but stands always offering grace along the way to each one as they have need and challenge each one as they have the requirement. I think this parable is ultimately a story to shift our attention, as it so often needs to be shifted, away from ourselves, away from our piety, our passions, our faith or our failure, our glory or our shame, and to shift that attention back to God, a God who delights in justifying the ungodly, who welcomes the outcast, and who is always healing all who are in need, if we would only seek God. And that shift shifts our focus as well from the limited, narrow reality of ourselves and our living and our way to the infinite focus of a world made ever new. And in making the shift, God gives us hope of knowing our prayer, whatever it may be, and embracing us in all of our lives and bringing us hope. May we always seek God, no matter our position, and may we be made newly aware each time of the marvelous, bounteous grace that God in our midst is working always, even to our own surprise. Amen.